Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour for June 2nd, 2022, in the ongoing series, the year-long epilogue of shows where I'm talking about the history of my discoveries. Right now, and in previous weeks, we've been in the middle of the 1980s. A lot going on there, but very interesting. The 70s and culmination of the end of the 70s and the early 1980s, the missions to the planet, the unmanned missions, etc., had stopped, and there was really nothing planned after that. But a lot was going on in the background, and not the least of which was the search for Planet X. So tonight, I'm going to talk about that. I'm also going to talk a little bit about my weather work, where it was getting its footing and basis here, understanding that Earth's weather depends strictly on electrical output from the sun, not the light. Even today, it's most bizarre that meteorologists and scientists think that the light from the sun is what powers our weather system. It's absolutely beyond absurd. If you only had light from the sun, you would simply there would be no weather. Just as simple as that. Also, something that was going on during these mid-1980s years for me is I was involved in a business that I started. And at the time, satellite TV was becoming a big thing. And at the time, if you're old enough to remember, there were these great big dishes. They were like 3 meters, so they're like 10 feet across. And people would put them in their yard or et cetera. And it was just very cumbersome. But I had a business selling these, and they were the mark of MACOM. MACOM was a telecommunications brand, very high. I believe they were out of World War II. And they basically built microwave telecommunications equipment. And at that time, these satellites that distributed the satellite signal were in geosynchronous orbits, and so you would lock in on one of these, and there was all types of parameters that you had to set, the polarization, the frequency, you had to move the satellite, and that was a process of positioning the satellite dish so it would direct at the satellite that was sending the signal. And so, in addition to this, at this time, I was also gainfully employed as a telecommunications engineer. And so, anyway, I was a senior engineer, and then a principal systems engineer was my final position with this company up into the late 1980s, and a very technical job. If you have any clue, this is back in the old legacy days, the computer IBM mainframe legacy days, and the telecommunications aspect of computing was very complicated because you had the central host and then you had all of this basically octopus of terminals that were out all over, in some cases all over the planet, that came in on dedicated lines into the central computer system where the processing occurred, and even down to the level of keystrokes. It would go off to the computer and would come back and put a letter on the screen. So it was very primitive. It was before distributed computing, and then I also worked in this business as distributed computing came along and displaced the legacy IBM systems. Okay, so anyway, just a little bit about weather work. Back to the MACOM story. It was during this time that I was in Minneapolis, St. Paul area, and I got to know a man named Stanley Hubbard. I went over to their office. It was in St. Paul, just across the river, KSTP Radio and Television, and Hubbard was the owner. And he goes back to the 1930s. So there was Stanley Sr. and then Stanley Jr. They were working at that time on DirecTV. And they were the first ones. They believed that the big dishes were not appropriate for the house, for the household, etc. And so therefore, what they wanted to do was to put the power in the satellite. So they were developing the satellites, the big first DirecTV satellites, where you would have a small dish on your house. And because there was a lot of power in the satellite, the rockets were big enough now and the technology advanced enough to where they could put a lot of power and then beam that down into a footprint on planet Earth. But anyway, I just wanted to mention at that time, getting to know Stanley Hubbert of KSTP and somewhat of an icon in the telecommunications and the television world, because he was in the development of these. In fact, he was instrumental in putting the first radios in police cars, interestingly enough, where he set up the radio telecommunications between towers so the police station could communicate with the police cars. Stanley Hubbert, back in the 1930s, he was doing that. That's when he was a young man. Okay, so just a little bit of history there. This has also an important role in me developing businesses. I developed throughout my lifetime a number of businesses. I'll be talking in the 1990s. I ran an archery company for a number of years. And so various types of companies, but this company selling MACOM, it was called Satellite Technology, based in St. Paul, Minnesota, and operating and selling MACOM telecommunications equipment, and of course giving me an understanding of all of that technology. Okay, I'll be talking a lot more about weather work when we get up into the 1990s, and especially the 2000s when finally my weather book came out, because people were saying, you know, you have all of this knowledge about weather, you have to put it into a form of a book. So the weather book, which now is out there, it's on my platform of books, etc., called Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather, took its roots in the 1980s because I came to the understanding that Earth and all the other planets were discharging the solar capacitor, that it was not sunlight that was powering our weather. And so this was a long-term development, understanding how all of this technology worked, and then, of course, replicating the work of Tesla, understanding what Tesla was doing was tapping into the vertical electric field. He did not know where it came from. My work pointed out where exactly this came from. Okay, so let me get into this topic of Planet X, because this 1980s period was when it all had its roots. And tonight I'm going to read, now this is was brought to my attention by a listener and said, I got an email and it said, hey, I found this old article. I don't know if you're interested in it, but I'll send it along. And it turns out to be a gold mine, an absolute platinum, gold, silver mine all in one of information regarding the search for Planet X. And so I'm going to dive right into this. This is a magazine that was put out, and guess who was the chief editor and principal on this magazine? None other than my good friend Carl Sagan. So this is very important. It's called The Planetary Report. It's a bi-monthly, so it comes out every 2 months. This issue is volume 8, number 4, July and August of 1988. And so I want to read who are the principals on this magazine. Now, once you get into the laundry list of who this is and what this is saying, my goodness, all of the Planet X deniers out there, or the what you might call the outreach people of NASA, etc., who poo-pooed this idea, none other than the board of directors, the president of the Planetary Society, the Planetary Report, is Carl Sagan. He's the president, head of the board of directors, and I have to expand this a little bit on my screen here so I can read it. He's the director for Laboratory for planetary studies at Cornell University. So this is back in the 1980s. And of course, in 1988, of course, I had been out of Cornell for quite a number of years, about 7 years, when this particular article came out. But it is so important to understand the basis here for the story of Planet X. Okay, next is Louis Friedman, executive director of the Planetary Report. Thomas O. Paine, former administrator of NASA, chairman, National Commission on Space. This is a federal commission advising the president on space issues. Bruce Murray, vice president, professor of planetary science at California Institute of Technology. Henry Tanner, California Institute of Technology. Joseph Ryan, let's see. So go down the board of advisors. Wait till you listen to this one. Diane Ackerman is a poet and author, but Isaac Asimov is on the board of advisors. Richard Bernstein is the president of the American University. Jacques Lamont, scientific director of university studies in France. Ray Bradbury. Now, Ray Bradbury is an author, and of course, Dune, other major international settlers. Arthur C. Clarke, author, is on the board of directors. I'll skip some of these. Okay, Frank Drake. He's the dean, Division of Natural Sciences, University of California at Santa Cruz. Frank Drake, the famous Drake equation. Whenever there was anything going on in the unmanned space program, Frank Drake was at the pinnacle, right along hand in hand with Carl Sagan. Look here. John Gardner, founder of Common Cause. John Gardner being a author and a spokesperson. Theodore M. Hertzberg, president emeritus, University of Notre Dame. I'm skipping over some of these. Gary E. Hunt, he's a space scientist from the United Kingdom. John Logsdon, director of space policy, George Washington University. Hans Mark, chancellor of the University of Texas. James Michener, if you haven't heard of him, James Michener, the author of so many amazing big novels. Marvin Minsky, Donner Professor of Science, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Philip Morrison, Institute Professor, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And, of course, Philip Morrison, a big name in physics at that time. Let me see if there's some more. Then Harrison M. Schmidt, former U.S. Senator, New Mexico, and former astronaut. And let's see, last but not least, bringing up the final person on the board of directors, James Van Allen, professor of physics, University of Iowa, after whom the Van Allen belts are named. Okay. Page 6 of this Planetary Report issue. Remember, it's July-August 1988. To put this into perspective, because it wasn't until into the 90s and into the 2000s when the absolute fanaticism over Planet X happened. This is 1988. Okay, page 6, Planet X, fact or fiction? And so I'm just going to quickly read the introduction here. Is there a 10th planet in our solar system? Get this, a 10th planet. Okay, they're talking about this is Pluto is definitely a planet at this time. 1988. Okay, I'm reading again. Is there a 10th planet in our solar system? Does Planet X orbit somewhere outside of Pluto, exerting subtle influences on other planets? You might think that with advanced telescopes, roaming spacecraft, and computer-aided calculations, by now scientists would have found any errant planets. But these questions are not so easily answered. John Anderson, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, is grappling with the mysteries of Planet X, and here he shares his work with our members. Okay, that's the introduction in from the editor's notes at the beginning of the article. Okay, so let me quickly jump up here. I got a second. Okay, Planet X Factor Fiction. And I'm going to go through this because it is so incredibly important. Before I start, now this is John Anderson. He is the top planetary science at JPL. So when the Voyagers and the spacecraft, the Pioneer spacecraft, were going out to the planets, the Venera, the Venus probes, etc., he was top man. And now he's talking about the potential for discovering Planet X. And I want to preface this. I want to repeat this at the end, but I want to preface this by saying the search for Planet X had been going on since the 1700s, since the Herschels discovered Uranus, and then the younger Herschel discovered Neptune in the early 1800s. So this goes way back, and as soon as they discovered them, the reason they discovered them because there was some oddities in the orbits of the planets. Something was pulling them out of their orbits. And so, this is why they discovered Pluto. In fact, Clyde Tombaugh discovered Pluto in the 1933 or something like that, searching for this object. And almost immediately, they discovered that Pluto was not the object either. So when they discovered Uranus, they said, "Oh, that's the object." And they said, "Well, no, it's not in the right place. It's not the right size." And then they kept looking, and then they found Neptune, and that's not the right one. It's not in the right place. It's not the right size. And then they found Pluto. They said, well, that's not in the right place. It's not the right size. And then eventually, Robert Harrington of the Naval Observatory, when Harrington was younger, he was not head of the Naval Observatory yet, in the early 1980s, when this search for Planet X really took foothold, and under NASA contract, the Naval Observatory picked up the football and ran with it, eventually finding it and having their first photograph in 1989, which was 1 year after this article was penned. But the point is that today you will hear people sing-song repeat the following, that the Voyager spacecraft that went out of the solar system, they did the grand tour of the planets, etc. People will quote this and they'll say, well, they would have been pulled by this Planet X object, and therefore that proves that there was no Planet X object. In this article, John Anderson, who is the head of JPL, the head of all of these planetary probes, an expert in celestial mechanics and tracking satellites, says specifically that no, what they discovered was that the Planet X object was way down in the solar system, way down out of the plane of the planets, and therefore the Voyager and the Pioneer spacecraft would not have been able to pick it up. They would not have been able to, their orbits would not have been able to be perturbed sufficiently to allow detection of this planet because of its distance way down in the solar system and because of simply that, it was just too far away. Okay, so this is really, really important now. And so I'm going to read through this. I don't want to read all of it, but it's just so important to understand because this is where this whole issue of Planet X takes footing. And then in 1991, the CIA comes in and takes over NASA. 1995, when Hale-Bopp is discovered, which turns out to its nucleus is the object that Harrington discovered. My book now, it goes through all of the details of this, Planet X 2020 update, the real history of Planet X. Okay, so now I'm going to go to this article. And remember, this is Carl Sagan. This is the top scientist of the day, 1988, proposing this without flinching an eye. Okay, so here we go. I'm reading this. And once again, thanks for the listener who brought this to my attention, because this is, like I say, a gold mine, a platinum mine, a uranium mine full of information. Okay. For those interested in planetary exploration, there could hardly be a more fundamental question than whether or not there are undiscovered planets in our solar system. Only 58 years ago, in 1930, Clyde Tombaugh, working at Lowell Observatory, discovered the planet Pluto, and in 1977, a search of the sky by Charles Kowal of the California Institute of Technology revealed the giant asteroid Charon, initially hailed as the 10th planet by the press. In 1978, James L. Christie and Robert Harrington, there's Harrington, of the Naval Observatory, discovered Pluto's satellite Charon. And so, now, don't confuse these. The giant asteroid Charon, spelt with an I, is in the asteroid belt. And so it was discovered, and it was a planetary-sized object in the asteroid belt. Charon, the one that Harrington and James L. Christie discovered in 1978, is a satellite moon of Pluto. Yet what did that do? That allowed them to calculate the mass of Pluto, showing that it was small and it was not the Planet X object they were looking for. Okay, reading on. Yet Charon is much too small to qualify as a planet, and even Pluto and Charon, the diameters 2,200 kilometers and 1,200 kilometers respectively, and more like satellites than planets, at least from the standpoint of size. Even the mean density of Pluto's Charon system, only about two times as dense as water, is more typical of large satellites such as Ganymede, Callisto, and Titan, that are combinations of rock and ice. Although the Pluto-Charon system and Charon, the asteroid, would be fascinating to study and explore, the possibility of a 10th planet offers us something far different, a planet on the scale of the Earth, or perhaps larger. Remember, this is John Anderson, head guy at JPL. The term Planet X, coined by Percival Lowell before the discovery of Pluto, is used for any undiscovered planet outside Neptune's orbit. So the planet X, the X is not mean, does not mean 10, although coincidentally it would have been the 10th planet after Pluto being the 9th planet, but it is, planet X is a placeholder for the name that would be given to such a planet once discovered. So X is not 10, the 10th planet, it means undiscovered planet. Okay, reading on. What appears to me as compelling indirect evidence that a planet X may exist, maybe in fact be telling us something quite different, perhaps something even more tantalizing. In fairness, I should point out that some of my colleagues do not consider the indirect evidence in the least bit compelling, and instead look to faulty data for explanations. So he's talking about his colleagues who are poo-pooing him for believing in Planet X, but he's going, no, those guys are wrong. Okay, reading on. I choose to ignore evidence taken seriously by some that borders on mysticism, such as ancient Babylonian texts, numerology, and mythology. So he's talking about Velikovsky here. No question about it. I'll read this again. He chooses to ignore evidence taken seriously by some that borders on mysticism, such as ancient Babylonian texts, numerology, and mythology. Although possibly valuable for other scholarship or for inspiration, such material is inappropriate even in the context of the scientific method. But let me explain what evidence we have. Now, I disagree with him here, because it's what Velikovsky did was gave us a treasure trove of information regarding the Venus event. That it was captured by Jupiter, it came through the solar system, it took many hundreds of years to nestle into its current orbit, all very valuable information. And the two events that the Mayans give us from the Popol Vuh, 54 years apart, the two events of Venus interacting with Earth. Okay, reading on. So now John Anderson is giving us his idea of what is convincing evidence. He says, first of all, we have no convincing theoretical argument that the planet system ends at Neptune. Before William Herschel's discovery of Uranus in 1781, the outermost known planet was Saturn. In 1846, Urbain Jean Joseph Le Verrier realized that perturbations in Uranus' orbit could be explained if another massive planet orbited the Sun outside of Uranus. So this is the last big planet, Uranus. And this guy, in 1846, through calculations, determined that there was another planet. This is going back into the 1800s. So Le Verrier sent his calculations to Jonathan Godfrey Gall, who discovered Neptune the same night he received Le Verrier's predictions. So they used this prediction, and it was resulted in the discovery of Neptune. With Galle's discovery, the radius of the known solar system increased to 30 times the average distance between Earth and the Sun. Okay, yet the distance of the hypothetical Oort cloud of comets is more than 1,000 times farther from the Sun than Neptune, while the nearest star Alpha Centauri is over 9,000 times farther than Neptune. To get an idea of the scale of the distance, let a U.S. dime represent our solar system with Neptune's orbit. Then the distance to Alpha Centauri is about 82 meters, or about 90 yards. There is still a lot of room for planetary orbits. Okay, so anyway, I'm going to step out of this for a minute here and talk about the there's photos, etc. And they know that there's something out there. They simply know it because of the calculation. NASA writes a contract with the Naval Observatory. And I also want to mention Tom Van Flandern. Tom Van Flandern is an astronomer that's working with Robert Harrington at the Naval Observatory. And Van Flandern is a proponent that the asteroid belt was created when a big planet, some Planet X object, smashed into another planet and blew it all to smithereens and created the asteroid belt. So this is where things are in 1980s. They are seriously pursuing this. Okay, so reading on. I'm not going to read. I'm just going to talk about the next couple pages here, where he talks about Clyde Tombaugh using the best technology of the early 1900s to do a search, because the belief was that if there is a planet, it's in the plane of the planets, or near it, up above or down below, although Pluto's orbit is quite a bit askew. But the belief was that if there is a planet out there, it must be near the plane of the planets, the ecliptic. And that turns out that that was not the case. And so there were two major searches. It was Clyde Tombaugh and another gentleman named Cowell. And Cowell had much better equipment. He could see much more detail. They did the comparison, and they said, nope, definitely there is no planet out there within this region of the solar system. But what they did not do, because the telescopes at Flagstaff did not see down to the southern hemisphere, they left that part of the search out of their search. And so it turns out that that's exactly where the planet was. Now Uranus and Neptune were in a position where they started noticing them being pulled down, both of them. And so they're like way out in the far solar system. They're being both pulled down. And so that tells Harrington that's where he should search. So he starts doing automated searches. He starts going down to New Zealand, which is where he can get a good shot of the southern hemisphere in the month of June. So in around 1986, Harrington starts these annual expeditions to New Zealand, and carrying an 8-inch astrograph, which is just almost a tabletop camera. And he brings the data back to the Naval Observatory, and they blink compare them. A blink comparator is a observing device. You have two plates, a photographic plates, one next to the other, one from 1 year and one from the previous year of the same area of the sky. And you adjust them so that when there's a light that blinks on one and then on the other. But what you do is, because of optics and mirrors, you're seeing just one photograph. So you see one photograph, then the other, one than the other on the same screen. And so what happens is if something moves like a planet, because the stars are so far away, they just stay in the same place, it's very easy to see that object moving. It's called a blink comparator. This is before the days of computers and computer searches, etc. And so in 1989, finally Harrington found an object that moved. So he says, okay, there it is. I see it. And then he went back in 1990, and then finally in 1991, he had enough data where he could actually calculate the orbit. And that's when Harrington discovered that Planet X was down there. He also had enough data to see that it had a companion. And when he took the calculations using that companion, he realized that it had about four Earth masses, the mass of this object down there. And so they found Planet X. And this was a serious discovery. But what they did also then, with 3 years of data, they were able to calculate an initial orbit for this object. It turned out to have an orbit of 4,200 years, and that's important. 4,250 years, actually. And that's important because in 1986, Robert Harrington met with Sitchin. And at that time, they were working on this. They were doing calculations. And Harrington told Sitchin that they believed that the orbit would be 3,600 years. And then Sitchin went out and publicized this, and it stuck for decades into the future. In fact, there are still people today talking about a 3,600-year orbit for Planet X. And, of course, it's simply not true. They don't know what they're talking about. They're passing along information that does not have a foundation, because when Harrington actually found Planet X, the orbital period was 4,250 years. Okay, so it's very important to understand this. And also from the context of the Voyager spacecraft. Now, going back to the Anderson article, he's talking about the searches that went on and in the plane of the planets, relatively close, 15 degrees north and 15 degrees south of the ecliptic, with very good equipment, and they were able to conclusively determine that there was none there. So now we're going to do something. We're going to make a triangle. We're going to make a triangle from the sun out to Pluto. And, okay, so Pluto is 40 astronomical units from the sun. And so we're going to do a triangle here. We're going to go out to Pluto from the sun. That's 40 astronomical units. And now we're going to go straight down out of the solar system, out of the plane of the planets, perpendicular down 40 astronomical units. And lo and behold, that's exactly where Harrington discovered Planet X. And so I want to talk about this issue of the calculations that had been going on. I'm going to read actually from the article here. This is, once again, Anderson talking about the work they're doing at JPL to understand the positions of the planets, because that's their job. So here he says, particularly at JPL, where the emphasis is on computing planetary orbits for the space program, we severely limited data on Uranus and Neptune to first include only observations made at the U.S. Naval Observatory with either the 9 or 6-inch transit circle instruments, telescopes that can measure planetary positions very precisely, and then to include only data taken after 1911, when a further improvement in instrumentation, the impersonal micrometer, was introduced. Using those data, as well as data extending back to 1886, astronomers, listen to this, here's the punchline, astronomers at the U.S. Naval Observatory concluded in 1971 that our current model of the outer solar system is incomplete. This could imply undiscovered planets. Just a second, I got to move my cursor here. Should remember unexplained motions. I got to get to the right. This could imply undiscovered planets, though we should remember that when unexplained motions were detected in Mercury's orbit, it took Einstein's 1916 theory of relativity to reconcile the discrepancies. Okay, They've determined, with a reliability of greater than 99%, that there is an unaccounted for influence on the motion of Neptune. They also concluded that we cannot rule out the source of gravitational attraction, including the possibility of a 10th planet with the mass that of Earth. Now listen to this part. This is incredible. This is talking about the actual measurements. Okay, reading from the article, the discrepancy in Uranus and Neptune's orbits are most noticeable over the years since 1846. This is how long they have been tracking this. Now listen to the following. The unexplained motions account for at least 440 kilometers, about 2,700 miles, in the location of Neptune and at least 2,800 kilometers in the location of Uranus. So it affected them differently. But understand, this is an extremely small measurement. Imagine the distance, the millions, millions, and millions of miles, hundreds of millions of miles from the sun to these planets, and the only discrepancy was 4,400 kilometers, less than about a quarter of the diameter of the planet Earth that we live on. So these measurements are extremely accurate. And they noticed that the issue started in around 1846. That's when this measurement began. And they already knew prior to that in the late 1700s when Uranus was first discovered that there was an issue with its orbit. They noticed that almost immediately. I also want to mention some work by Sitchin that's very important, that the Sumerians numbered the planets backwards. They didn't start at Mercury. They knew about Mercury, that if you were going out from the sun, there's Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, and then Jupiter. There's that big gap. Then there's Jupiter. Then Saturn, and those were the known planets for the Greeks, for the Romans, etc., because they did not have telescopes. But the Sumerians knew about Uranus and Neptune, and they talked about the blue planet being the first planet, because they counted the planets starting from the outside, counting in. So they did not know about Pluto. But they knew about Uranus. But Uranus is not detectable unless you have very good astronomical telescopes. So the Sumerians knew about the existence of Uranus, meaning they had capabilities that were beyond just the naked eye visibility of the planets in the sky. And so they also talked about this Planet X object, Nibiru, they called it, etc. And so this is an object that had been in the solar system around 4,500 years ago. Now, that's not that long ago. That's within recorded history. And look at the difference here. Now, the next paragraph is really, really telling. And this says it all. And this is the basis for the true understanding of Pioneer 10 and 11, which are now moving far out in the solar system, and the idea that they could be used to track down gravitationally this Planet X object. So I'm just going to read from Anderson's own words in this article. Remember the article from 1988. It says, new insights from Pioneer. So this is from Pioneer spacecraft, Pioneer 10 and 11. Puzzled by these discrepancies, I undertook a program a few years ago to examine the orbits of Pioneers 10 and 11 for unexplained motions. Pioneer 10 had an encounter with Jupiter in December 1973. Pioneer 11 visited Jupiter in 1974 and then proceeded to Saturn. Both spacecraft are leaving the solar system on orbits that take them far beyond Uranus and Neptune. Pioneer 10 is now 43.5 AU out, almost 1.5 times farther from the sun than Neptune, and Pioneer 11 is a distance of 25 AU, well beyond the orbit of Uranus. The two spacecraft, scroll down here, the two spacecraft are being tracked by NASA JPL Deep Space Network with radio equipment that allows the spacecraft's motions to be determined accurately at interplanetary distances. However, we found no unexplained motions that could be attributed to Planet X. Now listen to the following, because let me just put a segue in here. This is what people are saying now. Oh, there's no Planet X because Pioneer 10 and 11 did not discover it. Here's what Anderson says, and he's the expert, and this is 1988 when they're knee-deep in understanding the motions of Pioneer 10 and 11. I'm going to read from the article. Although negative, such information nevertheless tells us something about the characteristics of the hypothetical 10th planet's orbit. We know, for example, that there can be no planets of Earth size within 40 AU or so of either Pioneer spacecraft. So they put a limit. This is an upper limit. So if it's Earth size, it has to be 40 AU away from them. And this is why I'm drawing a triangle. If you go out to Pluto and or Uranus or Neptune, whichever, take your pick. Okay, and you go out and let's just take an average of 30 AU from the sun. You go down 40 AU down there, and that's where they discovered Planet X, out beyond the reach, so to speak, of the influences that were measurable for the Pioneer spacecraft. Okay, now listen to what he says. They don't drop it there. They don't say that's the end of the search. I'll read from the article. We will continue to monitor the motions of the two Pioneer spacecraft for perhaps another 5 years, when their power sources will become too feeble for radio tracking. For now, the search for Planet X must be guided by the unexplained motions of Uranus and Neptune and by the negative results obtained from the deep space network data. But at least one other piece of indirect evidence is significant. Okay, now he talks about Van Flandern and Harrington. I mean, this article is packed. Okay, simulating orbits. He says, Thomas C. Van Flandern and Robert Harrington of the Naval Observatory have shown with computer simulations that a planet with peculiar orbital characteristics and a few times bigger than Earth could explain both Pluto's orbit and the fact that Triton, Neptune's large satellite, revolves in a clockwise direction while other major satellites and planets move counterclockwise. In the scenario analyzed by Van Flandern and Harrington, Planet X passed sufficiently close to Neptune in the distant past that it expelled one of its satellites, which was Pluto, and reversed the motion of Triton. If this happened, Planet X is now in a peculiar orbit of its own with a period of about 800 years and a present distance of about three times Neptune's distance from the Sun. Robert Harrington has been searching the sky for this planet, but has found nothing yet. It is interesting that the planet he seeks is consistent with the Uranus and Neptune data as well as the negative results from the two Pioneer spacecraft. So anyway, he sees that the Pioneer spacecraft data it tells them something, that it's 40 astronomical units away. And so the search for Planet X did not die there. In fact, it picked up traction because now they knew better where to look for it. And so the last paragraph, so does Planet X exist? This is, remember, 1988. Nobody knows. It is an interesting possibility and, in my opinion, well worth the search, but admittedly not all share my view. Nonetheless, whatever the form of the direct or indirect evidence, I suspect there will be always a few people sufficiently motivated by the possibility of success to carry on the tradition of planet hunting. Okay, this is the article by John Anderson, senior research scientist at JPL. He's a member of the radio science team for Voyager 2 at Uranus and Neptune and won NASA's Medal for Exceptional Scientific Achievement for his work as principal investigator on the Pioneer 10 and 11 missions. Okay, so anyway, he also in this article makes the case that the orbit of this object is perpendicular to the plane of the planets, that it's somewhere way down below. And this eventually is picked up by Harrington. And Harrington starts to look down there in a place where nobody had looked before. And it did not take him long to find Planet X. And okay, so this article is 1988 August. It was the next year in May of 1989 that Harrington made his first discovery. And now it's very important to understand that Tom Van Flandern is mentioned here. It is very important because Van Flandern, after Harrington met with his untimely demise, death in 1991, shortly after his full discovery of Planet X, which was eventually to become the nucleus of Hale-Bopp, which I discovered. Tom Van Flandern went gray. In other words, Tom Van Flandern started saying that he did not believe in Planet X, etc., when he fully knew that it had been discovered. So they put the clamps on Van Flandern. They said, you do not talk about this. He knew what happened to Harrington, so I guess he liked breathing better than telling the truth. So he shut up. Van Flandern then, in 2004, becomes the handler of a new group that steps out. And remember, by 2004, I had my radio show. I was internationally popular. My books, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, was out. My book, Atlantis to Tesla, was out. Also the supplement, Surviving Planet X Passage. I had other books on the way. I was on radio shows internationally. I was being asked about these topics internationally, etc., in Japan and Russia, on Russian TV and Japanese TV. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, comes a group of charlatans to take over and just take my work and turn it into banana land, goofiness. And Tom Van Flandern becomes their handler for many years. And of course, the thing that they never talk about, they try and use Velikovsky's name. But the important point here is that it was what you call controlled opposition, so that they don't have to talk about me, because I was just becoming far too popular, etc. And by the way, at the same time was about when YouTube started to gain traction. And so I was banned from YouTube. In fact, I was banned from YouTube long before any other talk show hosts, some of the famous ones that have been banned and all of this, and shadow banning and all of the other types of censorship that went on. I was banned from YouTube right from the very beginning, so that if anybody put my name or my webpage in YouTube in a blog note, whatever, it was immediately removed. There was a huge counter effort to try and go out and smear my name. It was just absolutely insane. This is in the early 2000s. And then every Tom, Dick, and Harry, with their baseball cap on backwards, came out with a book, and these were all published by the CIA, the same printing house, because they used the same paper, the same glossy cover. And each one was predicting Planet X scenario, or Mayan end of the Mayan calendar, end of the world, 2012 end of the world, whatever. And so anyway, so very important here is that Tom Van Flandern, who was involved in this search for Planet X from the beginning, knew that Harrington had discovered it, knew that Harrington died an untimely death because he was very clearly going to go public with the idea that, with the fact that he had discovered this object, it was on a direct collision course with Earth when they first discovered it. It later lost timing because of the tail drag. And of course, when he discovered it, what's interesting too is they are considering that this is a planet that's just in some orbit around the sun, probably a big circular orbit. But they had the information from Sitchin of the Sumerians that this came in. And you'll notice that Harrington himself was talking about this object coming close to Neptune, causing planetary damage, just threw one of the moons out, which later became Pluto, and then reversing the orbit of Triton, the moon of Neptune, etc. And so they're talking about planetary interactions with this object. This is 1988, a year before Harrington actually made the first discovery photograph of Planet X object. way down in the solar system. So a year after this article comes out by Anderson in the Planetary Report, and remember, let's go back to the beginning where I read off all of the people involved in this periodical. It was Carl Sagan was the president. He had Isaac Asimov, Philip Morrison from MIT, and a long list of other very, what you would call, respectable people in the scientific community. But noting that Carl Sagan was the first person in line, and now granted that Anderson throughout this article talks about people who disagree, and he does it in a general sense, so you could give Sagan the benefit of the doubt that Sagan was saying possibly no to this whole venture. But remember, Sagan had done his Cosmos series, setting the stage for everything that had to come after, in 1979 to 81, the years when I was at Cornell. Sagan was in Hollywood making the Cosmos series, which, as I said, set the stage for astronomy, geology, evolutionary biology, anthropology, archaeology. Everybody had to follow the tune of Sagan, or otherwise you were ostracized immediately and tossed out into Never Never Land, never to return, never to be heard from again. Interestingly enough, through this entire time period, my work is central to all of it, and you'll notice that when they talk about Planet X, they talk in terms of planets. Nobody talks about this thing looking like a huge comet. And that's a very important point, because once you get into the disinformation of the 2000 era, the 2000s and in the 2010 era, etc., all of which have gone by, they always, all of these books that are disinformation have this something in common. It's a big orange ball on the cover. And it's very important because as I speak right now, we are in May of 2022. And back about 19 years ago, May 15th of 2003 was the date that was picked for the supposed appearance of Planet X on the horizon, and it would appear as a big orange ball and everybody was going to die. There were going to be mass suicides to make this the craziest topic ever, and then blame it on a full moon, which is this strange red moon that's due to the moon being in the shadow of Earth, but not the complete shadow, the penumbra, as it's called, and causing this reddish full moon. And very unusual. So oddly enough, we're having one this month. One of these rare red moon events are called a blood moon. And in 2003, but the point is about the 2003 crazy lady talks to aliens, May 15th, 2003, we're all going to die, is that the, and I'm saying that sarcastically, obviously, that the whole issue was planned in the early 1990s. By the CIA, who had taken over NASA, and they picked that date because the astronomers knew that that was the date of one of the blood moons, and that is used in what you would call secret societies as timing for changes in events and changes in their control of mankind, etc. Okay, now I just want to emphasize also, I have a book that's in my repertoire in my library on my webpage. It's called Planet X Update 2020, The Real History of Planet X. And I go through this entire history, but this article was a gem that was just somewhat unexpected and came from, like I say, a listener. The today, the official story of Planet X in relative to Harrington is on the disinformation website Wikipedia, and what they're saying is that, oh, Harrington, before he died, admitted that there was no Planet X. Well, Harrington didn't admit anything. He died very abruptly, supposedly from rapid onset cancer, as did Chuck Schrammick, a friend of mine who was a talk show host in Texas, who was one of the people who sent a photograph of Hale Bopp with its companion to Art Bell. Talk show host Art Bell, and then also Courtney Brown sent a photo This is in the mid-1990s, 1995, the day that Hale Bopp was discovered. Courtney Brown getting his photo from the University of Hawaii. Art Bell publishes this on his webpage, and all of a sudden, 37 people die in a so-called mass suicide in California, which turned out to be a mass murder. And because these people had a huge following coming into Los Angeles to go and observe the comet Hale-Bopp. And so this is a complicated story. I encourage you to read my book on this. These events actually were used to take Art Bell out at the peak of his success, at the absolute pinnacle of his success. And I was on Art's show with Art, with Whitley Strieber, talking about these issues and the fact that there was a companion to Hale-Bopp, the Canary Island Conference on Hale-Bopp, which was the international follow-up conference. The very first topic on the agenda was the companion of Hale-Bopp. And so everybody in the scientific community knew it, except in public for the newspapers, for the disinformation news media. They claimed, the astronomers from the University of Hawaii, Ali Hainau and crew, Weaver and Ali Hainau, claimed that it was Courtney Brown who forged the photo with the companion, when it was really Ali Hainau at the University of Hawaii who removed the companion. And they fully knew that there was a companion because it was talked about in the Canary Island Conference following this whole issue with Hale-Bopp. So very complicated story here regarding the true nature of Planet X. The end result is that the nucleus of Hale-Bopp, Comet Hale-Bopp, was the Planet X object discovered by Harrington. There's no question about it. And when Harrington was going to go public because it was on a direct collision course with Earth, that's when he met an untimely demise, and you could make your own conclusions there. And all of a sudden, Tom Van Flandern, who was the biggest proponent of this whole project to locate Planet X, goes gray and starts saying, well, no, there is no such Planet X object, while maintaining his own webpage talking about this planet that used to be between Mars and Jupiter being hit by a Planet X object and blown to smithereens. So you can see the contradictions here, and maybe he did that just as a way of expressing, the only way he could express his opinion. So and remember also that these shows are brought to you commercial-free. Remember my webpage, jmccsci.com, and the water filter webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. And the easy link to remember there is mymr5.com. You can use that to go directly to the Whole House Water Filter webpage, mymr5.com, or jmccsci.com, or jmccwaterfilters.com. Once again, thank you. And this was a very important lecture. Next week, we will pick up also on the mid-1980s. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.